Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. My name is Amy Wheeler, and I'm your host for today. This is a solo episode. Today, I want to bring some steadiness to a conversation that's been moving through the world of trauma therapy, somatic education, psychotherapy, yoga therapy, and the broader wellness space. And it's a formal critique of polyvagal theory. The critique was done by Paul Grossman. This is not his first. It's actually his second major critique that he has written for a peer-reviewed journal. And that critique has been circulating and generating some strong responses on both sides. Dr. Stephen Porges has also written his counter critique in the same journal. That's the nice thing. This time we got to see both of them. And then we have some leaders in the field that are actually speaking up and letting us know what they think. So I'll be talking a little bit about some of those people. I just want to start this conversation by saying we're not here to defend anything reflexively, or we're not here to dismiss anything prematurely. We really, as yoga people, we want clarity. We want to be able to discern and to align our language with the clinical reality of working with real humans in real time, and align our language with intellectual rigor. So, you know, that's where the tension here is laying. And this is what I want to frame from the start, that in academia, when a theory is questioned, that's a good thing. That means we're maturing, we're moving forward. And I don't think Stephen Porges and the polyvagal team actually have a problem with things being questioned. I think maybe more of what they're unhappy with is they feel that it's been a very personal attack. So we're going to have to separate some of that out too. But what we want to do today is kind of examine what the critique is, what it's actually saying. And I don't know about you, but reading those two papers, if you're not like a neurobiologist or a researcher, it can get very hard to understand what they're even fighting about. So we want to try to help all of our listeners understand, like, where are the points of friction and why? And then also, as we do that with those points, can we remember that human healing is complex and it's larger than any explanatory model? So we can't expect one model to be perfect and to account for everything. And I think this is where the people who are, you know, saying, but we've had such great clinical experience with this, we're getting results, people are resonating with it, they're kind of saying we can't throw all of that away. And then I'm going to layer on a third part here where we go back and compare these ancient theories of yoga, like the gunas, and look at how they intersect with this. Because I think something that has lasted for almost 2,000 plus years to help people suffer less actually has some value in this conversation, that maybe the Paul Grossman and friends researchers, the neurobiologists aren't looking at, and probably even polyvagal Institute and Stephen Porges aren't looking at that much, with the exception of Ariel Schwartz, who is heavily into polyvagal theory as well as yoga. And then, of course, Marlisa Sullivan and I, this has been something that we've been studying and writing about and teaching about for years now. And in fact, we even have a book that has a lot of this information coming out in the summer of 2026. So this topic is particularly of interest to Marlisa and I, and it's why I decided to do a podcast for you to kind of set the stage. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. My name is Amy Wheeler, and I am your host. Today, we're going to do a solo episode with me, and we're still going deeply into the eight limbs of yoga this year. So let's go ahead and get started. Let's go with part one, setting the context and what it is that polyvagal theory offered that has become so influential, that people have really found valuable. Basically, what Stephen Porges and his team did was give many clinicians and educators like language for what they were already seeing, that people are experiencing shifts of state, which we know as the gunas, interesting, but now I feel overly agitated and now I feel relaxed. Now I feel really, really, really scared. And now I'm so exhausted, I feel like I need to collapse, right? That's what we mean by shift of states. And that when we have these shifts of state, and in this case, Porges and friends are saying this is a nervous system shift, it also affects our perception, how we see the world, how we hear things, how we see things, how our brain comprehends and understands the information or the data that's coming in. And here's the real part of it, that this is not just cognitive data, that it's actually embodied within us. We have a shift of state into agitated or relaxed or collapsed. We have a perception. That perception is actually embodied in our cells, in our nervous system, and that it has a lot to do with safety. And that oftentimes, if we can figure out how to regulate ourselves and feel more safe in the moment from within, or we can co-regulate with someone else that's basically already regulated and feeling safe, they can kind of help our nervous system also become safe. So one of the beautiful things about polyvagal theory is that people are no longer blaming themselves for having these normal human states, these normal outbursts, these normal times that we say things we wish we hadn't, these very normal way of being overly emotional or jumping to a conclusion, that it's not a personal failure. It's not immoral. It's just that our biology is talking to us. And because we have been trying to survive for most of our life, our nervous system is trying to protect us and keep us safe, and it can be pretty dysfunctional. And so it's taking it away from the diagnostics of like the DSM-5, although there could be some of that if you're a licensed healthcare practitioner. But really, this is talking about lived experience and being kind and compassionate with yourself and finding ways to make your life more manageable so that you can feel safe more of the time. It's a little different than positive psychology. It's not like we always want you to feel great and replace the next positive thought. It's more that your nervous system is going to go through these states, and that's a normal thing, that we're rotating through the states. Again, very close to the gunas in yoga, and that we have a little bit of control over these states too. So the Porges, you know, 40 plus years of publishing hundreds and hundreds of peer-reviewed articles came up with language for this, that people can be like, ah, that's what I'm feeling in my body, and coin terms like neuroception, which is this kind of unconscious feeling inside of you that you don't even know is happening, that's asking, am I safe? Am I not safe with this person or the situation? That idea of safety and lack of safety, and you don't have to use that word if you don't like it. You could say stability, centeredness, calm. There's other words you can use if safety isn't your thing. Also, Porges offered language for things like co-regulation. When you do feel good in the presence of another human and you feel like there's some trust and rapport and that you can open up to them and be, again, safe with them. And also gave us language about these autonomic responses of the nervous system and the patterns that each of us has tended to develop inside of ourselves in a way to survive, probably since very early childhood. So what this did when we had this language and this model, it helped people to feel less ashamed of their activation or their shutdown or their hypervigilance. It was like, oh, my nervous system is trying to help me. It's trying to protect me. It may be dysfunctional. I may do things, say things, be ways that I wish I hadn't. But now I have a model to understand what was happening, and I can work top down. I can work with cognitive strategies to help me soothe those reactions that I'm having. And I can work bottom up. I can change my physiology to help my brain understand that it's more safe. So that's kind of the impact that polyvagal theory has had and why so many people have resonated with it. And that's a very clinical experience, if you will, as well as a lived experience. It's more than clinical. It's how do we feel in this human body? And so We can't deny that there has been such a strong resonance with this. The neurobiologists, what they're saying is that may be happening. It's fine. You clinicians, you go do that. But they're basically saying, we don't think what you say is happening is actually happening. It may be a lived experience. It may resonate, but the science is not quite specific enough. So let's kind of move with this part two into the critique itself. First of all, I want to just say, Paul Grossman has made a career out of trying to get more specificity from some of these more lived experience researchers. It's not just Stephen Porges that he has basically had critiques of. Richie Davidson from the University of Wisconsin, who is a huge mind, body, and mindfulness researcher. Many of you know Richie Davidson. In the early days, there were many times where he wrote articles to critique Richie and Richie's work, and there's been others also. So I think, first of all, we have to say this isn't necessarily a personal attack just on Stephen Porges, as some people have suggested, but there is a pattern of saying, hey, don't get too new agey and fuzzy in your language here. We want it to match up with science. So what Paul Grossman and his colleagues raised concerns about with respect to polyvagal theory is kind of the evolutionary framing that as we emerged from amoeba all the way to the human experience, that maybe there's some misperception there. And then, you know, the strength of evidence that are supporting certain claims around heart rate variability, and that basically the popularity of using something like heart rate variability, vagal tone, I'm going to tone my vagus nerve, while they may be popular, they may be part of pop culture, Paul Grossman and colleagues are saying it doesn't really work like that. We don't really love that, lumping everything into the vagus nerve does this, the vagus nerve does that. So what Paul and colleagues are not saying is that regulation doesn't matter. They're not saying that these state or autonomic shifts don't exist. They're not saying that clinicians and their clients are imagining things, but they are saying we want to challenge the science and the precision, and we want people to say what's real. And also they want people to say, we don't know yet, or this is still a bit fuzzy. We're still trying to figure this out. So this is one of the most important points, is this is where Grossman's feedback has been really helpful, that as we translate polyvagal, are we being too simple with it? And, you know, we see this all over Facebook and all over LinkedIn and, you know, let's do these three exercises to tone the vagus nerve, that type of thing. Maybe we have simplified it a bit too much, because here's something that I didn't know until I started researching this. The vagus nerve, it's not like one nerve that has an on switch and an off switch. It's a complex pathway of 100,000 or more fibers. So think of that vagus nerve as 100,000 or more fibers. And all of these fibers are serving diverse functions across multiple organs and systems. So again, it's not like, oh, we're turning the vagus nerve on or we're turning it off. Each of these 100,000 fibers has a job to do in your liver, in your heart, in your ovaries, or, you know, wherever all the fibers end up. And so these fibers are all doing different jobs. So when the public-facing version becomes turn on your vagus nerve or flip into ventral vagal, we've kind of crossed the line of what is useful into a very oversimplification that can really distort the physiology. So it's almost like we're using it as a metaphor, turn on your vagus nerve, but we can't mistake the metaphor for what's really going on in the science. And so that's really the crux of what Paul Grossman and colleagues are upset about, is that we too have joined in on that fun and are saying things that actually aren't true within the world of physiology, and that it's gotten a bit out of hand and they want to pull it back. Now, if we accept that, if we kind of curb our enthusiasm a little bit and we start to say, okay, well, I better figure out a little more precise language around this. I'm going to get a little more training to really be able to talk about it in a very scientifically valid way, but also a way that still helps my clients. We then start to look at, well, what does that look like? And I think Dr. Ariel Schwartz had a reflection on this. She wrote a Substack article about it. And her position, as I read it, it was not defensive, but it was very clinical. And she acknowledged on her Substack article the value of scientific debate. And she also named that clinicians of polyvagal find it useful because it's helped to organize the human experience into words and into a model. So she clearly said, you know, both can be true. And she asked us to hold both of those truths at the same time, that we can, and we have had some overreach of the evidence, and we need to refine our claims. And she said, please don't dismiss this polyvagal framework that has helped so many people offer more compassionate, less judgmental, state-sensitive care, that the neurobiologists have to acknowledge that, okay, maybe we haven't been speaking of it correctly, but you have to admit this is doing something good for people, and people are healing and feeling better, and it's taking us out of the diagnostic approach into the we are human, we have a lived experience, and there's something that we can do to feel better more of the time. And I think that's important because that's exactly what yoga says. And that's probably why, in my opinion, Ariel Schwartz kind of nailed her Substack article right on the head and basically said, yeah, we can hold both of these truths. So, you know, the distinction that she wanted us to kind of hold together is that clinical usefulness is not the same as anatomical certainty. And that because the anatomy is so complex and we can't get all that out there in every conversation, and especially not in our marketing, it doesn't erase the lived experience, right? So I really appreciated Ariel Schwartz's Substack. I think it's worth everybody going to read. All right, so let's go to the next part. And this is one of my favorites. This idea of lived experience and how our community can talk about these lived experiences and how can we hold disagreements together. And I actually think this goes beyond Polyvagal Institute and polyvagal theory and the researchers. We as yoga people have a lot to learn from this, just how we communicate with one another. So the thing here is that when critique surfaces, it can feel destabilizing to the entire community. And people start to take sides and they start to fight and they start to get catty. And we think somebody has to be right, and that means somebody has to be wrong. And I think what we really would like to have is, can we come together and have a discussion without one side going silent and stonewalling and not participating at all, without the other side going after people and getting angry and having a witch hunt where we're going to burn people at the stake? Like, I think many of us are guilty of one or the other, maybe some gray area in between. So some people really kind of got overactivated by in the polyvagal debate between Grossman and Porges, because they were like, okay, even if all of this is correct, why does Grossman have to be so mean about it? That was kind of the idea. And we've heard the same thing in our yoga world. Why do they have to be so mean? We have a chance to reflect as yoga practitioners. Are we responding reactively, defensively? Do we think we know something? Do we have avidya? Do we have certainty? Are we trying to publicly shame one another? Right? When these things happen, do we call each other one-on-one and say, let's have a Zoom call? I'm really confused. This was hurtful. I'd like to discuss this. Or do we shut down and stonewall? Right? Or do we fight back? And does it always need to be public? Can there be some things that are happening privately behind the scenes? Are we keeping lines of communication open? And if we could get regulated within ourselves and allow our humanness to come out, but also allow our curiosity, our ability to hold multiple truths and kind of look at the complexity of the situation and to somehow try to stay connected even when we disagree. And I think this is a huge problem in our community right now. I'm seeing that we're not being curious, we're not able to hold complexities, and we're not able to stay connected. People have gone into camps, into teams, and they're not talking to each other. So this is big. This is not just in academia, but it's also in the yoga community. And so I just want to name that most of us are participating in that. We're not staying regulated. We're not staying open and curious and willing. And we're not actually going to solve the problems that we need to solve together, which is going to be painful. It's painful now, and it's going to continue to get more painful. Similar to if Porges and Grossman teams can't come together and have a conversation, it could continue to not make progress and not mature and also continue to be painful. So first we get regulated. Then we do our best to continuously come together with some emotional intelligence. And every time I'm able to do this with a colleague that I've had a misunderstanding with, I always come out a better person, understanding where my gaps were, what I didn't see. I get more information that I didn't know about. And I think most of them would say the same. So I don't know why we don't do it, but I know that it's not happening. And I know that until we figure out how to do this together, we're probably not going to solve any big problems. And the outcome of that is bad for all of us. Just like it's bad for Porges and Grossman, we as yoga people and our community and our desire to share this work in the world is going to be stunted, if not stopped completely. So this is something we all have to take to heart. And I know I'm thinking a lot about it. What would this look like? You just shut down. You just think, I don't want to. I don't have enough bandwidth. The XYZ judgment, we have of each other. We don't think that we can do it, but I'm telling you, we can. If we decided to, we can. I'm going to take just a couple of minutes away from this episode to tell you about our Masters of Science in Yoga Therapy at Notre Dame of Maryland School of Integrative Health. Hi, I'm Amy Wheeler, and I am the department chair. And I am so proud of what is developing at Notre Dame of Maryland in this Masters of Science program. It is the only Masters of Science at an accredited university in the nation, and we're doing such great clinical work. We find that because of the clinical setting, the electronic medical records, and the training that we can give through a university setting, that our graduates are finding jobs out there in the field of yoga and yoga therapy. With a master's degree, in addition to your certified yoga therapist designation, I think you'll find that it's much easier to find work. We would love to talk to you more. We have one open house per month. If you email me, I can help you find out how to get to the open house and how to get more information. Check out the show notes and let's get you looking into Notre Dame of Maryland's Masters of Science in Yoga Therapy. Thanks so much for listening. Back to the show. So, one other thing that I want to kind of bring up today is something called phenomenology. Say that with me. Phenomenology. Phenomenology. Phenomenology is the basis of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. It basically means I am rooted in this lived experience that I'm perceiving directly. I'm not asking other people. I'm not inferring. I'm actually perceiving my life through my eyes, my ears, my mind, my nervous system. And it's actually valuable, my experience. It may not be accurate. That's the problem, but it is valuable and it is important. This is what Patanjali says, is that you are here in this human vessel to experience through your prakriti, through this human system. You are not the ever-evolved purusha. You do not have complete clarity. That your job here as a human is to come in and experience the world through your little container and try to get more clarity in this very short lifetime that you have about your little container. And if you do that over and over and over, you might have the clarity of purusha one day. So when we look at Yoga Sutra, chapter 1, verse 1, we're kind of widening beyond neuroscience, and we're looking at states, just like polyvagal is. We're looking at perception. We're looking at relational capacity. And these are all the things that polyvagal theory also values. This is why Marlisa Sullivan and colleagues wrote this seminal paper on, oh my gosh, the gunas and the 2,000-year-old teachings of yoga actually mirror very much like what polyvagal theory is outlining. And that actually, I want to pause for a moment. That gives me hope, because even though polyvagal theory has some refinements to do in terms of modern science, it's actually very connected to the ancient teachings. So that gives me a feeling of it's going to be okay. There's coherence here. People have been using these ancient teachings for thousands of years to feel better. And polyvagal theory is very much a good match for that. Not perfect, but there's a lot of overlap there. So to me, I don't get as frazzled about these scientific refinements that need to happen, because I know that there's some deeper underlying truth that we as yoga people have known about for a really long time. So we don't have to measure it and reduce it to a mechanism before we explain it and understand it and feel it. We know from our philosophy that it's got some truth there, and we can trust that. And science will catch up, and polyvagal theory will be refined. So when we look at this big word, phenomenology, it begins with observation. And that is Yoga Sutra 1.7. What is the quality of my mind right now? What is my experience, my external experience coming into my internal interpretation of that experience? What does agitation feel like in my body and breath? What does withdrawal or even collapse feel like? What does clarity and social connection feel like? All of this is about how am I experiencing the world, and what inner sovereignty is, what yoga is trying to do for us, is help us to know that those fluctuations of the mind, those qualities, those textures, that agitation, that collapse, and some days the clarity, is the fluctuations. That's not who you really are. We can get a handle on that. We can feel better more of the time. We can try to get our gunas to, you know, be a little less rambunctious. But ultimately, even when they are being rambunctious, there's also a whole nother part of us that knows, actually, that's not the true me. That is the vessel that I reside in. And I can rest in my humanness as well as my divinity and know that both can be true. So that's why the Yoga Sutra remains such a steady text for us, because it doesn't begin with theory or science. It begins with, hey, you as a human, you're going to have this direct experience. Now we begin the teachings of yoga through your direct experience. And it's a doorway. It's a doorway into saying, welcome to being human. This is the guidebook for being human. And where do you want to start? Because your observation, your perception is what's real for you. And that's okay. It's okay to be human. It may not be accurate, but that's why we're here. We're here to get clarity and figure out how we can be more in alignment with reality, with the big R, right? So it's slowly, the four chapters of the Yoga Sutra are going to help us have this pathway for how we can get our reality to match with the reality that is out there by cleaning our lens day after day after day through personal practice and through these teachings of yoga. The second sutra, chapter 1, verse 2, Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha, is basically saying, look, we're going to have to get these fluctuations, these states, back to polyvagal theory, we're going to get them to settle a little bit, or at least learn about them so that we know what's happening and why we're feeling the way that we are. So this is very much language mapped around the phenomenological experience of being human and first person experience. You can observe the fluctuations of your mind. You can observe your agitation, your dullness, your clarity. And pedantry is basically just mapping out these patterns of experience that, again, match beautifully to polyvagal theory, right? We've got the agitation is more the sympathetic dominance. We've got the dullness or the withdrawal or the collapse is more dorsal vagal. And then we've got the clarity and connection, which is more ventral vagal. So this Yoga Sutra as a guidebook, it trains us to observe ourselves and to watch ourselves and to continuously refine our reactivity, our perception, our communication, our behavior, and basically become more skillful in how we meet life. And again, I'm going to go back to our problems as a yoga community. We're not being very skillful. It makes me wonder if we know the Yoga Sutra, if we have read that, if we understand it, if we are doing the work. And why is there so much fear at moving forward and trying to figure this out together? All right, so let's take it in a little different direction now. The gunas from Sankhya philosophy, which kind of gives the original framework for the gunas. And again, it extends back thousands of years. And these gunas or these energies are the fundamental qualities of being human, of experience. But also everything in the universe is made of these fundamental qualities in different proportions. So you have rajas, which is activation, movement, could be agitation. That's going to be more like sympathetic dominance in polyvagal theory. You have tamas, which is more inertia, more heaviness, more collapse. That's going to be more like dorsal vagal. And then you have sattva, which is clarity, coherence, steadiness, connection. And that's going to be more ventral vagal. Now, some people might say, did Stephen Porges know about yoga? Did he know about the gunas before he mapped out polyvagal theory? I'm going to guess, yes, he did. I can't say for sure, but I'm going to guess, yes, he had studied some of these concepts from Indian philosophy. I'm not saying he based polyvagal theory on that, but it is very, very possible that these ideas came across his mind over the past 40 years. So when we compare the gunas to the more modern polyvagal states, there is a meaningful overlap. Is it exact? No, it doesn't map exactly. But at the level of phenomenology or lived experience, I would say there's probably a 70% overlap. There's quite a bit there. And this is why us yoga people love polyvagal theory for the most part, and why the paper by Sullivan et al. Was so popular, because we were like, here's some science that's reflecting back to us what's already been resonating within us. Now, here's the key point where we're going to bring it all back to the Grossman argument. The guna model does not depend on a single nerve. The gunas don't turn on and off. They're just constantly in motion. And to impact the gunas, we impact the entire lifestyle. We're not just doing a vagal nerve stimulating machine on our neck. We're saying, get some sunshine, go out walking, be in nature, eat regular meal times with healthy food, go to bed at a certain time, get up with the sun, do a little movement in the morning, have your most potent thinking time at certain times of day, allow yourself a little rest in the afternoon, enjoy your family in the evening. All of this comes from yoga and Ayurveda. So that's how we create sattva. That's how we create ventral vagal. It's not just dependent on the vagus nerve. And I would argue that even in polyvagal theory, Stephen isn't saying it's all dependent on the vagus nerve either. But that is kind of a scientific, easy way to describe when you do these lifestyle things or think positively or give your body pleasant signals, it could have a very strong impact on how your vagus nerve is functioning and all the different functions that correspond to the larger vagus nerve, those 100,000 fibers all doing their functions. So I think that's where the simplicity that we all tried to just be like, hey, the vagus nerve, it's good for it. That's where we kind of got caught up, and we can go back and refine that. So we can't flip the vagus on, but the bridge between science and yoga, we can act with more responsibility. We can talk about cultivating flexibility of the nervous system across the states and recovering quickly with resilience. We can talk about what to do when you're in more of a vagal collapse versus when you're highly sympathetically oriented and you don't want to be in those states because it's not functional for what you're doing at that time. We can talk about how to change patterns over time, especially if they're not functional for us. And we can also work to increase the conditions for the possibility of ventral vagal or sata, if you will, to be around more often. So we're not eliminating anything. We're not eradicating anything. We're just cultivating an environment where it's possible to feel better more of the time. So when we look at it from the yoga perspective, it's not a yoga technique. It's not like forward bends will relax you, backward bends will activate you. It's a whole lifestyle, a way of living, a way of thinking, a way of perceiving, a way of communicating, and a way of showing up in the world. And this is why I'm a little concerned that our community isn't really understanding Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. I mean, I think a lot of people know the yamas and the niyamas and the kleshas and they know a few of the concepts, but have they actually learned the whole guidebook, which is about this lifestyle, living, thinking, perceiving, communicating, showing up? I hope that as we mature as a yoga community, that we all start to learn the Yoga Sutra more deeply, this guidebook for being human, because yoga, it's not just about the tools. It's not just the breathing, the meditation, the mantra, the mudra. Those are the tools, but the tools are at the service of lifestyle, living, thinking, perceiving, and communicating, right? So we have to remember the true function of why we're even doing this in the first place. And so when we kind of reduce things to a single technique, we're actually reducing the whole path. And instead, I want you to expand the path and figure out what's the function that we're trying to achieve here, which is more sattva, more ventral vagal, and more flexibility of the nervous system, more flexibility of the mind, more ability to recover after challenge. And what are the tools or techniques we need to use to get that? And so that's the beauty of probably therapeutic yoga and yoga therapy, is that that takes some time to learn. And it's not something you can just cognitively memorize. You have to actually implement it and do it yourself and live it yourself for it to really come across as authentic. I think I'm going to end with one of my favorite sutras. Since we did Yoga Sutra 1.1.1.2, I think we have to talk about Yoga Sutra 1.3, because this is the real goal. Tada drashtuhu svarupa avastanam. Then the seer abides in their true nature. This is not a claim about the vagus nerve. It's not even about, I want to feel better, I want to co-regulate, I want to be in a regulated state, right? It's about, who am I? Why am I here? How can I be of service? How can I be in relationship to myself in this human vessel? And then hopefully help others too. That's the real goal. We don't want to miss that. It's not about balancing the vagus nerve. It's not about getting into sattva. It's about seeing who you really are, which is not the fluctuations of your mind. It's not the highly sympathetic state. It's not the dorsal vagal state. It's your true nature. Who are you? What is your Purusha like? And from that place, we accept the journey that we're on, that I want to remember that. I want to remember my true nature. All right, so let's just do a little summary, some practical takeaways, and talk about how we can proceed together with integrity. Here's a few takeaways. We welcome critique and we don't panic. We stay curious, we stay open, we stay communicating. Woof! I had to start with that one, right? That's not easy. I make it sound so easy. Number two, going forward, we're going to clarify what is metaphor, what is measurable, and maybe not overstating the facts because we want to teach responsibly. Number three, we claim and honor our lived experience. There's nothing wrong with claiming that. We don't have to get science involved to prove that our lived experience is important. That phenomenology has been around for thousands of years, and that's how people have been living. That's the truth. Fourth, we remember that yoga philosophy is not competing with neuroscience. We're just describing the same terrain from different perspectives, and we'll refine that over time. And then fifth and finally, we are not reducing yoga or yoga therapy to techniques. Yoga is an integrated way of living, and that's why it works. That's why it makes us feel better. So let's close with this steadiness. Let's go out there and model this. Let's do our daily practices. Let's do our best to come back again and again and have hard conversations and then regulate ourselves and then try again. And let's try to mature our field of yoga, and let's try to help the field of polyvagal theory and maybe even the scientists. Let's help them mature too, because not everything is a threat. And we, as yoga people especially, we don't have to fall on a single model. We've been doing this for a really long time. The gunas have been describing regulation and dysregulation for over 2,000 years. And the Yoga Sutras have been guiding us as humans towards more discernment and steadiness. So we can welcome the science. We can welcome the critiques. We don't have to feel like something's being torn out from underneath us. And I think with that, I'll just say thank you for being with me in this conversation. And I will see you next time on the Yoga Therapy Hour. Have a great day. Thank you for being a listener of the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. We have done over 200 episodes, and we have had over 200,000 downloads. And we hope that in some small way, we have supported you mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. If you'd like to support the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast in 2026, there's several meaningful ways you can do so. First, you can become a member of our Patreon community and donate as little as $5 a month to keep the podcast going. Your contribution helps us to sustain the depth and quality of conversations on the podcast. A second option is that you become an Optimal State mobile app member for both Android and iPhone. Again, this is about $5 a month, and we're going to start providing a lot of amazing content on our mobile app in 2026. We'll definitely want you to be part of that community. We also have a book coming out called Applications of Therapeutic Yoga in Integrative Health. This book will be published by Routledge Publisher in spring 2026. It's written by Amy Wheeler and Marlisa Sullivan. We hope you'll consider purchasing this book when it comes out in the spring of 2026. Again, the name is Applications of Therapeutic Yoga in Integrative Health by Wheeler and Sullivan. For those of you who are seeking advanced training in therapeutic yoga or in yoga therapy, please consider checking out the programs at Notre Dame of Maryland School of Integrative Health. We have a MS in yoga therapy, and we also have a post-master's degree therapeutic yoga for licensed healthcare providers that's starting in the fall of 2026. In addition, we have a comprehensive Ayurveda certificate program also geared towards licensed healthcare providers. Each one of these programs is a pathway designed to support healthcare professionals and yoga teachers and yoga therapists who are ready to integrate these teachings into clinical, education, and community settings. All right, thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast.
We wish you a wonderful week. We hope that somehow, in a small way, we've contributed to your well-being so that you can go out and share that well-being with others. That's what life is all about, bringing in the goodness through you and then shining it out to the world. We need you more than ever. So let's all get out there, do good, be good, and have a great week.